Thank you. So, two quick questions before I start. Andre talked about the Lucasville uprising. How many of you have heard of the Attica uprising, the 1971 Attica prison uprising? Okay, that's most people. How many of you have heard of the 1974 August Rebellion? Okay, so I will start with that. Women's resistance, whether it be riots or less visible organizing, is usually not as noticed and not as researched as organizing and activism among men in prison in the U.S. The 1974 August Rebellion was sparked when five male guards at New York's maximum security Bedford Hills Correctional Facility beat a prisoner organizer and placed her in segregation or solitary confinement without a hearing. Ironically enough, the prisoner organizer, whose name was Carol Crooks, had won a court ruling the month before stating that the prison was not allowed to place prisoners in solitary confinement without a hearing. In response to this beating, the women around her protested, taking over portions of the prison, fighting off guards, and holding seven staff members hostage. The women held the prison until the state called in male state troopers and guards from male prison. While they were taking back the prison, 25 women were injured, and 24 women were transferred to the Mateo 1 complex for the criminally insane, again, without the required hearings. So one question I want you to keep in mind while I speak is, why do we hear about Attica, but the August Rebellion, which happened only a few years later and at a time when prison issues were still really hot news for the left, why is it that that's virtually forgotten today? This is not the only time during that time period that women have rioted. In 1975, women at the North Carolina Correctional Center for Women held a sit-down demonstration to demand better medical care, improved services, and the closing of the prison laundry. The guards tried to herd them into the gymnasium to break up the sit-down demonstration, and instead of allowing themselves to be passively herded into the gymnasium, the women took the volleyball net poles, chunks of concrete, and hoe handles and physically drove all of the guards out of the prison. And it wasn't until over 100 guards from other prisons were summoned that that the prison was able to be taken back. Yesterday, when I did a workshop with Rita Bo Brown, a former political prisoner, she actually told a really interesting story that I hadn't come across in any of my research of newspapers, leftist newspapers, books, etc. In the 1970s, at the women's state prison in Nevada, the psychiatrist, a male psychiatrist there, was forced drugging the women and over-drugging them, and one woman died as a result. After her death, when the psychiatrist visited the prison, the women attempted to stone him. They threw everything they could at the man and drove him from the prison. In response, not only was the psychiatrist replaced, but so was the warden and several staff members, and they were all, so the entire administration basically was replaced with, hopefully, a kinder, gentler administration that at least was not going to be forced drugging the women. Women have also been organizing in less visible forms, both then and now. And since I'm in California, I'm going to start with some of the organizing that's occurring in the women's prisons in the state. At the Central California Women's Facility, which is a few hours from here, women incarcerated began a peer education program about HIV/AIDS, hepatitis C, and other communicable diseases. This is especially important considering that women in prison have HIV and AIDS more, have a greater frequency of having HIV and AIDS than their male counterparts and women on the outside. The incarcerated women went from prison yard to prison yard talking to their peers about these diseases and urging them to get tested and to seek treatment, because in prison oftentimes there's a stigma against having HIV and AIDS and people don't understand it. People are reluctant to get tested. If they do have HIV and AIDS, they're often stigmatized and ostracized. There are attitudes that you would think would have gone out in the early 80s, like, I don't want that person sitting next to me. She might breathe on me. I might get HIV. I might get AIDS. So the peer educators go from prison yard to prison yard and really do intense one-on-one education to make sure that people understand what exactly the disease is, how you can get it, how you cannot get it, and also what kind of treatment you should be looking for. So this resulted in more women getting tested and seeking treatment. And it also resulted in more women learning how to read their medical charts and how to demand better medical care for having HIV and AIDS and any other related illnesses. In 1995, women in the Central California Women's Facility filed a class action lawsuit, Shumate versus Wilson, charging that the California Department of Corrections was denying medical care to those with cancer, heart disease, and other serious illnesses, and that the prison medical staff was failing to protect the confidentiality of prisoners with HIV and AIDS. So the prison basically was not doing things to make sure that everybody didn't know that you had HIV and AIDS, so the medical lines would have separate lines or separate times for women who needed medication for having HIV and AIDS. So everybody would then know if you were standing on this line at this time, you are HIV positive. As a result, 2 years later, the California Department of Corrections entered a settlement agreement, and they agreed that untrained prison employees would be barred from making judgment about medical conditions, so they couldn't say to a woman, you're faking that seizure, I'm not calling for medical. And medical staff would start to offer preventative care for health concerns, including pelvic and breast exams, pap smears, and mammograms, none of which they had been doing before this lawsuit began. In addition, outside activists formed the California Coalition for Women Prisoners to support the lawsuit and the women inside who are organizing. To this day, the group continues and has expanded its work. It visits and corresponds with women, advocates for compassionate release for women with terminal illnesses, and raises public awareness about the issues. That group is right here in San Francisco. I can give you more information later about it if you're interested. In the early 1980s, women incarcerated in California formed a self-help group called Convicted Women Against Abuse. It was women in prison for killing their batterers. And first, they started it as an informal self-help group, realizing that so many women have been incarcerated for killing their batterers. And this was at a time when battering and domestic violence was not really in public consciousness. People didn't understand what battering and domestic violence was. There was a prevailing notion that if a woman was beaten and she didn't leave, it was somehow her fault, that she somehow incurred this type of abuse. And when women finally fought back, they often got long prison sentences, and oftentimes their testimony about abuse was omitted from the record. They weren't allowed to say, well, this person has been beating me and battering me and abusing me for X number of years. This wasn't allowed to be entered into evidence until later on. So the group originally started as a self-help group, and it wanted to educate women about abuse, empower them to recognize it, and then speak out about it. Then they tried to start a clemency drive, inspired by a mass clemency drive organized by incarcerated women in Ohio a few years earlier that had resulted in 25 women being granted clemency. The women in California attempted to organize a clemency drive. They wrote a letter to then-Governor Pete Wilson asking him to consider commuting their sentences and inviting him to one of their weekly meetings so that he could understand how they ended up in prison and what the effects of abuse were. Wilson declined. He also said that he was not going to consider mass clemency for every single woman incarcerated for self-defense in the state of California. Instead, he said he would consider the letter as a request for clemency only for the women who had signed it. He ended up granting clemency to 3, denied it to 7, and made no decision on 24 of the other women. But a larger, or I guess more far-reaching result in terms of prison organizing and prisoner rights support is that their letter and their efforts drew the attention of outside advocates and lawyers who first helped the women draft their arguments and gather evidence for clemency petitions. These outside advocates and lawyers formed the California Coalition for Battered Women in Prison, which is now called Free Battered Women, that to this day also continues organizing, raising public awareness, and advocating for the release of women in prison for self-defense. And this past October, one of the other co-founders of Convicted Women Against Abuse, Brenda Klubine, who had been denied clemency by Governor Pete Wilson, was released through the efforts and the advocacy of Free Battered Women. So as you can see, this organizing didn't just happen once and had one result. It has continued over the years. Outside of California, women have also organized to protest their conditions of confinement. In Michigan, in December 2004, the Department of Corrections moved 817 women to the Huron Valley Women's Prison, which had previously been a psychiatric hospital that had the capacity to hold 400. So they basically moved twice that number of women to this former psychiatric hospital. The women filed hundreds of grievances about their living conditions, including overcrowding, a shortage of toilets, the inadequate medical care, and a lack of hot water and heat. Their efforts forced the prison to start providing heat. And if you have ever been to Michigan or any place north, you will know that December is very cold. So they basically forced the prison to provide heat, which may not seem like a huge victory for prison abolition, but it is a huge victory for people inside prison that need to suffer through these conditions. And the prison also was forced to begin construction on a cafeteria, which it had not had. Women incarcerated in Gatesville, Texas, in December 2007, filed grievances, again, en masse, about the lack of heat. Texas may seem like a warm place, but in that area, temperatures can drop down to 34 degrees in the winter. Women who were more confident about their writing abilities helped those who weren't, so it was a mass effort on the part of everybody incarcerated in that facility. As a result, every woman was given a second blanket, and one dorm, where they could not get the heat to work at all, was evacuated, and the women were sent to dorms where the heat did work. In addition, the lieutenant that was in charge of those housing areas, who had continually lied about the fact that the heat wasn't working, was placed under investigation and I think eventually fired. One last bit of or anecdote about women's organizing that doesn't seem to capture media attention or activist attention or widespread attention is a project called the Free Bus Project in Florida. Incarcerated women are often placed in facilities that are very far from their families, both because prisons tend to be very far from urban areas where the majority of incarcerated people live before they were arrested, but also because there are still fewer women in prison, even though their number is dramatically increasing. There are fewer women and there are fewer prisons, so you don't even have the option of quote-unquote behaving yourself to be sent to a prison closer to home. Most states only have one or two women's prisons, and these prisons tend to be very far from urban areas. In the 1990s, one prisoner named Iraida Guanipa read about a church program that provided free transportation for children of prisoners in Virginia. And so she decided that she wanted to have this implemented for the women who were incarcerated in her facility, which was in Coleman, Florida, about 300 miles from Miami. Most of the women in Coleman had never received a visit from their children during their entire incarceration. It took her about 8 years, but she finally found groups and mostly churches, but maybe some other groups, that were willing to pay for a bus to bring about 300 children to come and visit their parents, most for the first time. So this is another form of organizing that kind of slips under the radar because it's not considered sexy, it's not an uprising, it's not a riot. So any questions? I realize I have only 5 minutes left. And I just threw a lot of information at you. I'm Russell.
The numbers of women rising compared to the number total of people who are being incarcerated?
Women's incarceration is increasing faster than male incarceration. And I don't have my book with me where I can tell you what the statistic is and where it came from. But women's incarceration has been rising exponentially, and the rate of men's incarceration has actually decreased. So this is, women still make up roughly 7 to 10% of the entire prison population. So it's not like they've suddenly become 50% of the prison population, but their numbers are increasing. There was that fellow. Okay. I originally was involved more in doing support for male prisoners. I started as a teenager supporting my friends who were going to jail and then to prison. When I was in college, I started doing research about prisoner organizing, prisoner resistance, and uprisings post-Attica. And I was really frustrated by the lack of information about women prisoners' resistance. And I was told again and again, women don't organize, which I thought was complete BS. And I just thought, well, maybe I'm not looking in the right places. So I began researching the issue, and I noticed that there are a lot of different issues that confront women in prison. So while they share the same crappy health care that everybody in prison shares, there are also the female-specific issues. While many people in prison are parents, when a male goes to prison, there is a mother, a girlfriend, a wife, or some female relative that usually will take in his children, when a mother goes to prison, typically she's a single head of household before she gets arrested, or if she has a partner, the partner may be arrested with her or may have split. And so she has to rely on family to take in the children, which may not happen, and there is not necessarily a social support network for that, so her children are more likely to end up in foster care. And under the Federal Adoption and Safe Families Act, if your child has been in foster care for 15 of the past 22 months, the state will automatically terminate your parental rights. And this is an issue that affects incarcerated mothers much more than incarcerated fathers. So I started researching that and then looking at the different ways women are challenging this and resisting this, which are very different sometimes than the way that we think of prisoner resistance and prison rebellion. Yes?
What are some of the main reasons for more women?
There are the mandatory minimum sentencing laws. In 1973, New York State passed the Rockefeller drug laws that said that if you had 4 ounces of a narcotic for personal use or 2 ounces of narcotic for sale, and I don't know how they figured out if you were going to sell it or not, regardless of circumstance, past history, lack of a past history, whatever, you would get 15 to life. And they were the first state to pass a mandatory minimum sentence. The judge couldn't say, well, you're a mother of three, you've got a newborn, you know, like this happened to be in your car, but it was actually your boyfriend's. You couldn't argue any of these things. You just automatically got 15 to life. And other states followed suit, and now I believe every state has a mandatory minimum sentence. So women are getting sentenced under mandatory minimum sentences to longer time and more time, whereas maybe before they would have gone into like alternatives to incarceration, like a drug treatment program. Also, there are other laws like the Anti-Drug Abuse Act of 1986, which allowed people to indict for conspiracy. So if I am living with somebody and Joe calls up about a drug transaction that I know nothing about, I can just write, Joe called, on the message pad, and that could get me an indictment and a conviction for conspiring in this person's drug offense. Does that...
Uh-huh. I'm wondering, like that seems like it would affect both men and women.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering, why is it specifically that female incarceration is on the rise?
Well, you also have to look at things like the feminization of poverty. Like in 1996, there was welfare reform. And this meant that women with past drug convictions were not eligible for welfare, so there was no social safety net. If you're coming out of prison for a drug conviction and you need to make some money fast to pay your rent, to get food, you know, to get your children back. So I think there was a study done that between 1996 and 1999 alone, more than 96,000 women who were on welfare previously were now deemed ineligible solely because of past drug convictions. And there haven't really been any follow-up studies as to how these women are now able to make a living. Like, they judge success by how many people get off welfare, but they don't track where do they go, what do they do, you know. You can't just lift yourself up by the bootstraps if you don't have any boots, type of thing.
I'm working to stop the expansion of a jail, and a lot of times the politicians, they use this rhetoric that there's not enough space in the jail for women, or they don't have privacy.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, how do we combat these, like, both human rights and women issues?
Well, yes. One of the things that I wanted to sort of end on is a cautionary note that we shouldn't be looking at, you know, we shouldn't be, I guess, buying into this idea that, like, we need more jails so that women have better conditions. Thank you for bringing that up and kind of bringing that back. Because in 2006, the California Department of Corrections announced that they'd done a study and they'd found that 4,500 women currently incarcerated in California actually don't need to be in prison. Instead of releasing them, they're recommending that they build these mini prisons that are going to be kinder, gentler, more humane prisons, you know, mini or female corrective centers or something crazy like that, that are going to be closer to the urban areas where women originally lived before their arrest. But they're not closing any of the 4,500 beds that they would be vacating in the prison that they were in. So this essentially means that more women can be sentenced to prison. Judges who are not under the obligation to sentence somebody because they fall under a mandatory sentencing guideline might say, well, that's not such a bad place to go because you would get drug treatment, counseling, blah, 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 blah. there, you know, as opposed to saying, why aren't we having more drug treatment centers on the outside? Why aren't we having more vocational centers on the outside to help people cope with these, you know, cope with not being able to find a job, not having the skills? Why don't we have more childcare so that women don't have to choose between working and leaving their children in dangerous situations, or, you know, like having to do something in the underground economy that could possibly get them busted because they don't have affordable childcare? So it kind of like factors in all these issues of these prisons, mini prisons, jails, what have you, aren't doing anything to address the existing social structures that are sending all these people to prison. Other questions? In California, no, but that's because the California Prison Guards Union is against this. Because if you have a private contractor coming in, then that means they don't have to hire your unionized guards. They can hire Joe Schmo out there for $7 an hour, provide him or her with minimal training, minimal supervision, and kind of like cut costs so that they can make a profit from the people that they're incarcerating. In other states, there has been this move, but it's not actually saving any money. Other questions? Other comments? No? I would say no. I mean, why would you lock up a first-time nonviolent person and take them away from their community at the cost of $40,000, $45,000, $50,000 a year to the taxpayer per person? You know, so 4,500 times 40,000 is quite a bit of money that could be going into our schools and our childcare centers and our roads, and, you know, the list goes on and on. Yes?
Yesterday, when you spoke, you had said that there were people in prison who transferred out of state to California and Arizona.
That was actually Bo. But there are interstate transfers now where they feel that there are too many people in prison, and they will actually transfer them out of state. Hawaii is actually one of those that. I don't recall if Hawaii actually doesn't have a women's prison, or if their women's prison is small, and therefore they transfer women to places like Kentucky and Tennessee, where there's like not any sort of cultural connection, there's not any sensitivity, and they are super far away from their families, and they're never going to see their families. So there is more of a trend towards shipping prisoners back and forth. More than 80% have reported being mothers of children under the age of 18. But there aren't any agencies that are required to collect this information, and a lot of mothers are reluctant to report this. Like, so if I get arrested and my child is with my mom, I'm not going to tell the arresting officer that I have a small child, because then you start getting child welfare involved. She could enter the foster care system if they say that my mother is too old to care for my child during incarceration, and then that would start the clock ticking towards my child being in foster care and me losing all rights. And there is no social service agency that's collecting this data. So between 80 to 95% is what I've read. Yes?
It's kind of worrying, like being somebody on the outside. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and that's great, because I actually have a card for something that is coming up in San Francisco, for those of you who live in this area all the time. Free Battered Women, which is the group that came out that emerged to support the Convicted Women Against Abuse, Battered Women Support Group of incarcerated domestic violence survivors, is having a celebration and fundraiser on Saturday, March 28th. At the Women's Building, and that's at 3543 18th Street in San Francisco, and it starts at 3:30 and goes on till 6 p.m. And they are also going to have several formerly incarcerated survivors of domestic violence come and speak about both their stories and their organizing, both inside and outside. So that's one thing that you can do. There's also the California Coalition for Women Prisoners, which is in San Francisco. Justice Now, which works with people in prison in, I believe it's also in San Francisco, someplace in the Bay Area. There is Critical Resistance in Oakland, which does more to work towards the dismantling of the prison industrial complex. This lady in red said that she was working with a group that was fighting the building of a jail, so you can also ask her more about her group too. And a plug for my book, or a plug to actually look at my book, is in the back, is a resource list of other groups doing work with women in prison across the country, so you can just flip through to the back and see if there is anything listed in the area that you live in. Am I out of time? Okay, thank you very much.